This is a Pinball News production.
Hi, good evening once again, everyone. Great pleasure to be sitting here talking to Barry Owsler, the well-known pinball designer. I did a quick check just before supper, and I've counted up that Barry has designed 30 games that actually went into production, and several other games that maybe were pinball and didn't go into production, or were games other than pinball and did go into production. So just to kind of get a flavour of how familiar we are with Barry's work, can I ask if you can raise your hand if you have owned a Barry Owsler designed game? Okay, well, quite a lot. Can I just now get you to shout out some of the games that you've owned that were designed by Barry?
Dirty Harry,
Cyclone.
Dirty
Harry, Cyclone. Doctor Who,
Junkyard.
Okay, so we've got quite a few. Well, what we're going to do this evening in the 45 minutes, maybe an hour that we've got, is basically get a guided tour through Barry's life as a pinball designer. I'm going to ask Barry to start off in a moment and tell us about how he got his first gig as it were as a pinball designer. And then I've gone through Barry's catalogue of games and I've chosen several that I'm going to ask him to talk to us about in a bit more detail. Okay, Barry, so over to you. How did you come to be a pinball designer?
Really, I started working at Williams right after I got out of high school. I graduated on Sunday, started working in the factory on Monday, and spent a couple of years in the factory, and then went up to engineering, got an offer up there, and worked as a technician, was building up the games for Steve Kordick and Norm Clark, or whoever was designing at the time. And right around 1978, they were starting to run short on designers there because they'd gone over the Williams, either out of pinball or to another company. And I had an idea for a game called Phoenix. I wanted to design it and talk to Steve Kordick, and you know, Warp Ross was in charge at the time, and asked if I could do my own game. And he said, you know, go ahead and draw it up, because I had experience in drawing up the cable harnesses and just watching Steve and other people the way they did the games, and just tried to draw it up myself and came up with it, and they liked the game. And then the rest is like history after that.
So, after Phoenix, you did Time Warp, and then you moved on to Gorgar, which was a bit of a landmark game. Not only was it the biggest production run with 12,000 of any game you designed, but it was also the first game where the public got to hear pinball machine talk for the first time. Could you tell us a little about Gorgar, please?
The Gorgar game idea, I wanted to put a magnet in the game where it can grab the ball and hold it and do the game layout. But as far as the speech, I mean, our electrical technicians were working on talking for games, and they happened to be ready right around the time when I was doing Gorgar, and management decided to use it on the Gorgar game, but we're limited to maybe 8 or 10 seconds of speech. You can put, you know, a dozen words in there, and that was it. So we had to record everything in monotone and just basically mix the phrases or different words up to make different sentences. That's why Gorgar kind of sounded a little, I don't know how to describe it, but you know, like a caveman almost, the way he talked.
Okay, and then moving from Gorgar, jumping ahead a little, you designed a game of which very little is known called Enforcer. Now this game never went into production. And can I ask you to dig deep in your memory and tell us what you can about Enforcer? To help you, we've got the back glass on. So we've got your stomach doing this one.
I know, this one's got me stumped.
Right. Well, I wonder.
Okay.
I wondered if there was any connection with, I think there was a Clint Eastwood movie, Dirty Harry, at the time.
I don't believe so. I mean, vaguely remember the artwork, but I don't even remember working on a game with them. It's been so long now.
Okay.
A lot of times I draw up a game, I didn't like the way it looked. I just scrap it, throw it on the side, and work on something else.
All
right, so we'll skip on to Solar Fire. Now, Solar Fire was one of four games that Williams produced with a two-level play field. I think the others, off the top of my head, some new kid did something called Black Knight, and then there was Jungle Lord and Pharaoh. But I don't know about other people, but for me, Solar Fire has near mythical status. Very few came into England. It was something like 6 or 9 came into the UK. Could you tell us about Solar Fire, please?
From what I remember, we're trying to just kind of capture like the Star Wars, Battlestar Galactica type of theme, and I was into a lot of sci-fi movies, and I like the name Solar Fire. I kind of stole the name from an album cover, a Man for Man's Earth Band album cover. It was called Solar Fire, and I liked the name, so I decided to make a game and call it Solar Fire, and then just kind of just developed a game around the idea, and then they decorated it with the artwork, you know, these flying spaceships and, you know, different battles in it. So it's a little bit like a Star Wars type theme.
Okay. And then you mentioned names, which leads nicely into the next game I'd like to talk to you about, which is Barakora, a somewhat strange name. Could you tell us a bit about the history of the game itself?
Sure.
The original game, it was a theme that, not so much a theme, but the actual game itself was Roger Sharp and Steve Epstein. They had a game they wanted to draw up, and they basically drew up a rough sketch of a play field, and I was asked to try and, you know, make the game work, and I drew up what they had, and the game was basically a piece of crap, so. So I told them, let me redesign it, and, you know, I'll make a better game out of it. So we did that, and then back in the early days, a lot of times they had artwork done by this company called Adposter. They come in with artwork for a game for a back glass, and we would use that as our theme. We weren't always picking our themes for the games. And somebody had one with this fish-headed woman, like a barracuda woman. I mean, I know a few of them. But I mean, it turned out to be an interesting game. A lot of people seem to like it.
It had the weird arrangement with the flipper buttons, where you had lane change both on the left and right flipper with the letters over the top, rollovers.
Right.
And then the other thing, which I think when Steve Epstein and Roger were working on the game, they called it Las Vegas. Well, if you try and transfer the name Las Vegas into Barakora, you don't have enough letters, and that's why on the left-hand drop target bank you see double R, which was the value of just one of the drop targets.
Right.
Okay. I think it was Doug Watson who did the weird artwork. I think it was based on a lady in the movie industry that he was quite fond of, quite taken by. So if we move on then, the next game I'd like to talk about is Cosmic Gunfight. And the reason I've chosen this one to talk about is I discovered recently there was some, well, it started off inside with a different name.
Yeah, the original name, I was calling it the game Dragonfly. And we had the artwork was sort of like a Silver Surfer type character with wings. There it is right there. And I think we had those backlights made in like 10 different colors just to see which one looked the best. But then something came up, I think, I don't know if it might have been Germany or France, or somebody wanted something more of a sci-fi theme on it. So they talked our management into changing the theme. They wanted more of like a fighting type thing. So we ended up doing basically a cowboy movie in space.
And next we're going to look at a game of which someone's been generous enough to bring an example, which you can see out on the floor later, and that's Defender, which clearly was your translation of a video game into a pinball machine.
Yeah, I think it's the only pinball game I can think of that was actually modeled after a video game. I mean, other than Joust, but this one actually, we tried to incorporate the rules of the actual video game into the pinball machine. We had the landers and what all the other characters were called, the baiters and different names, the smart bombs. There's a feature on it with the extra button. If you hit that button, it'll basically kill all the characters on the side, the landers, when they try to steal your people. I mean, we didn't make as many of them as I wish we would have, but for its time, it was a good game, but it had a lot on it, too. I think it had more coils than any game we'd ever made before.
And then moving on, we've got Space Shuttle, which is quite legendary, because round about the time of Defender, up until Space Shuttle, pinball took a bit of a dive, and history suggests that's because of the surge of interest in video games was hurting pinball really badly. And I think you got a lot of praise for rescuing pinball and bringing it back with this game, which sold quite a lot of units. I'll tell you how many. Space Shuttle took the numbers up from running in their hundreds to actually 7,000 games. And the other thing that I'd like to ask you about is the Space Shuttle model that appeared on the game is generally thought to be the first appearance of a toy on a playfield. How did that come about?
We figured it was a Space Shuttle game and I wanted to do something on it to make it a little more 3D, and ended up going out and buying an actual model of the Space Shuttle and building it up. And then we kind of made like a vacuum form mold from that model and had to cut the tail down so it could fit under the glass. And the story too behind Space Shuttle, the original drawing, it was Joe Kamikawa and Larry DeMar drew up a Space Shuttle drawing on a napkin, and they wanted me to make a game like this for them. So I took one look at it. I knew the game wouldn't work, but people don't believe you until you actually show them. So I built the game up. They played it, and it played like garbage. So I just basically scrapped the whole thing and started from the beginning and started working on a new game. And right around that time, management was going around checking all the games that everybody was working on, what stage of development we're in. And they told us that the next game that isn't a hit, we're going to shut the factory down. So they ended up going with Space Shuttle because it was farther along, and I think they liked the theme and the layout of the game better. And that's where it took off from there. If this had been a bad game, that might have been the end of it for us.
Was it necessary to get any permission from people like NASA? Did anyone at Williams have to contact NASA in order to get permission to use their name on a pinball game?
Well, that's what Joe Kamikawa did. He was in contact with NASA, trying to get the license for us and get permission to use everything on there.
Okay. So moving on, the next game I think we're going to look at is Comet. Now, as the flyer tells us, this was a chance to score a million. And I guess throughout recent pinball history up to this point, the scores were getting bigger and bigger. And now we have a game where you've got one shot that made a million.
I guess we just try to take it a step further with Comet. We can get a little bit higher score. I think people are used to doing that in video games. And another thing about Comet was kind of based on an amusement park in Chicago called Riverview. And we were going to call the game Riverview, then I guess people decided that nobody outside of Chicago knew what Riverview was. So I decided when I was using the name of one of the rides, I'm sure it's Comet rides at a lot of different arcade or different amusement parks, and designed it all around that theme, putting a roller coaster on there and the motorcycle jump later on, something different on the other carnival themes. And then we got Python involved. I think this was the first game I did with Python. And he was just a madman with all the artwork on it. I mean, he put no one character. If you look in the back, I think it was John Belushi in there and some other people. He'd use their images. And on the playfield, he'd sometimes take images of people that worked at Williams and hide them as little people. Like there was one guy here, kind of a, if you look at the aerial view, he kind of a big belly on him, sitting on it, so he can't fit us. And if you look at it, it had the same hairstyle, the same shape. or you put some little obscene person doing something in the corner around there. You'd have to basically look at all 300 or 400 people out there to find what they're doing.
Is this the guy who's got Ronald Reagan in the front of the train?
Cyclone. Oh, sorry, that's
Cyclone. Yeah, we don't have a picture of that. Who did the voices on this guy?
I know Steve Kordick did the million shot, and I know we had Mark Ritchie help up with some of the other voices on there. I can't remember, was this the one with the Dump the Dummy, or was that Cyclone? I'm trying to remember. I think this is Cyclone. It was Cyclone. I think the Spook House was on Cyclone, right? Yeah. I think it was Steve on that one.
Did your voice appear in any pinball games?
Gorgar mainly, and also Jokers. But there's another story behind it.
How did you know going out to Jokers? Now tell us.
Now, the way we did the voices on Jokers, there was me, there was Bill Futzenbreiter, and Mark Ritchie, and a tank of helium and a bag of balloons. And that's how we got all the little character voices on Jokers. You know, they're Jokers, right? We'd just be there laughing and giggling, and we'd do this for 15, 20 minutes and take a break for about a half hour because we're all getting lightheaded. We might have been able to pass out, and then we'd just do another take and do some more voices. I mean, it was a lot of fun. There's a lot of crazy things that went on.
You mentioned Platt and Angelo, who unfortunately we lost this year. But you worked with him quite a lot, probably more than anyone else. Can you tell us a little more about what it was like working with him?
It was an adventure. I mean, you never knew what you were going to get with him. With Comet, it was okay, but it seemed like after Comet, he would just start working on a game, show you what he's doing, and then disappear for a month, and you couldn't find him. I mean, his mother couldn't find him, his wife couldn't find him, management couldn't find him. It's like he just fell off the face of the earth or got abducted, I don't know. And he'd like wait till the last 3 or 4 days of a project to finally start doing some artwork on it, to finish it up. And then he'd be complaining, I've been working for 3 days straight, man, with no sleep. I can't do the accent anymore. Mark Ritchie does a good version of Python. But, I mean, he always came through and did a great job on it. But sometimes I think, you know, the manager was just biting their nails waiting to see if he's going to get it done because they need to get production set up and you can't do it if you don't have artwork. And they just never knew when he was going to be finished.
Well, just mentioning about Python going missing and then taking a side street for a little while. On A Brighter Pinball, I think it says something like Concept by Python. I know it wasn't your game, but I think the artwork, for example, I think, was it Johnny Alcy that actually finished that off?
I believe so.
And would that be because Python had gone missing in action, presumably?
I believe that's what happened with it.
Yeah, I think that's why a lot of times they couldn't rely on Python to finish the job, so they had to get someone else to finish it. We had a similar thing on Hurricane, where Python started the artwork and somebody else had to finish the backlash on it.
Okay, great. And so, moving on to the next game we're going to talk about, which I think is Pinbox. Now this is really, I just think of this as another landmark game. Can you tell us something about this, please?
Well, I know this is the first game I did that was actually designed around the artwork. Python had come up with this whole layout with the robot with flipper fingers and all these little drawings of characters, and I basically just took everything he did and brought it to actual life by making mechanisms that actually fit in. He had like a little corkscrew thing on it, but somebody had to actually make it work, and he had an idea for a robot with a visor, and I decided to put the visor, but I put the target crank in there to make it something you could shoot at, not to something that moves and doesn't do anything. But almost everything that's on there was like part of the artwork originally, and just took the whole thing and designed a game around it.
Well, I think we're going to come back and reference this game again soon when we talk about Doctor Who, and perhaps you can tell us when we get there what the connection is between the two. But meanwhile, we're going to move on and talk about fire. Now, the reason I'm asking you to talk about this is because, if I remember rightly, there was fire, and there was fire champagne edition. I'm not too sure, my memory's a bit sketchy, but as I recall, wasn't champagne edition sold as a conversion kit of some sort?
I don't recall it being a conversion kit. I know they made a special run with just the champagne edition where it was all hand-stained artwork on the cabinet. They stained and varnished like a piece of furniture, put a decal on it, had brass rails on it, brass legs on the game, and the big ringing bell on top, and they also had two fire wheels in the back glass that would rotate on there. It was like a little more expensive version, and for people who want to buy it, they want to put it in these, they used to call them fern bars in those days. We had the big bars with the brass rails and the plants in them, like the TGI Fridays and stuff like that, and that's what they wanted to try and capture games into that kind of location.
So I think what you're telling us is with the Champagne Edition, it was really the first game that came out in kind of a Pro and an LE version.
Right.
So, okay, thanks. The next game we're going to look at is Police Force, which I think started life as a different game. So once again, can you tell us the background as to what it started as, what it ended up as, and what changes you had to make on the way?
This was the first game that I actually collaborated on with another designer. I worked on this with Mark Ritchie, and the game was originally going to be Batman, the first Batman movie with Michael Keaton. And we had, I mean, a lot of it done. You know, parts of the artwork, the playfield was all laid out, all the rules were laid on it. And there was some kind of, I don't remember exactly what the problem was, Gary might even remember more than I do, where they had trouble getting the license for the game. And we ended up just coming up with our own theme. And I worked out with Mark Ritchie and Python and Bill Futzenreuter and basically came up with the police force theme, but Python had the idea of making the police animals instead of them. I mean, at least they made them lions and make them pigs or something. I think some people would have objected, but that's basically where the theme came from. The car on the side was originally the Batmobile moving up and down on there instead of a police car.
I think the story I heard at the time, and I don't know how true it is, that typically you guys working at Williams would get about 9 months to design a game, and I think the movie people, what I heard was they weren't too happy to wait 9 months. I think the movie was due out and then they wanted the game out at the same time. And some newish company on the block, I think they're called Data Reese, told the movie people, give us the license, we'll give you the game in 6 weeks. So, because I think that's what happened.
Right.
The Data Reese game came out a few months later. So moving on, the next game we're going to look at is Doctor Who. So perhaps you could say a little about how Doctor Who came into being and its relationship with Pinball.
And this was a game that our programmer, Bill Futzenreuter, wanted to try and do on his own. And it was another game that he tried to actually draw up the game and didn't work out, and I ended up stepping in and basically redesigned the whole playfield on there. And what I did, I liked the Pinbot Bank, and I would try to think of a new way of using it and decide to make it into a three-level playfield where you can have the part where you lock the balls, there's another part up on top with hitting the targets, and then the third part where you can shoot through these little trap doors and go under the playfield in a little subway. I mean, that's the main, I guess, comparison between that and Pinbot, the way the bank would move up and down, except this would have a third level on it. And Bill was a big Doctor Who fan. I'd seen every episode, and I was happy to work on it with him. We both liked the show a lot, so decided to do a game, except we made it a little more cartoony instead of having actual photographs.
Thanks for that. Now, the next game we're going to look at is another game that I think
originated in the mind of Python Angelo. I think the full title is, can we sit down there? Is it Popeye Saves the World?
Saves the Earth.
Saves the Earth. Why stop there? Okay, so this game has a somewhat, let's say, colourful reputation. And for one thing I know, they changed the upper playing field, didn't they? That started off, I guess, obscuring the lower playing field. So later on they made an aftermarket, I guess you'd call it an upgrade, where the upper playing field was transparent. Could you tell us sort of what that was like from your end?
I mean, during production, I don't remember really well that we... Did we actually do that? Make it transparent, or was that an aftermarket thing?
No, I think it was Williams that did that.
You might be right on it. It's just hard to remember every single game. It's been a while. This was a game I didn't even want to work on, but nobody else wanted to work at Python at the time, and the management basically threw him at me on this game. He's got, they loved him. They'd do anything he wanted, so we need someone to make a game now. It was another similar game where he drew up the artwork, and the game was kind of designed around the artwork done instead of the other way around. I had my own little ideas of things like the way that little ramp worked on the side. You had like a kicker that would kick like five kickers at one time, so wherever the ball went, you'd still be able to knock the ball down that little channel. And putting the little wheel on where the ball locks in there. You have like a skill shot where the wheel's spinning around like a roulette wheel, and you have to try and time your shot to go right into the right hole to get whatever reward you wanted. But this was like what he had in his mind, and nobody can ever understand why Popeye wants to save the Earth. This wasn't like the cartoons. He's just fighting Pluto, and that was it, and trying to steal the girl.
I think the question is, if I understand rightly, did Python enjoy smoking herbal cigarettes?
I don't know if he was smoking or sniffing, but he was doing something.
So moving on, we come to your final game for the time being. Hopefully not your final game, but at this point, you're still with Williams. This was the last game you did for Williams, which was Junkyard.
At Junkyard, I had an idea to do a Junkyard game I had for years and just never got around to doing it. I wanted to actually do a game that had all parts from all different games on it. It would be like more like a pinball Junkyard, but just when you kind of look at it and start laying the parts on it, they just didn't seem to fit or have a good flow at the game, so I ended up making it more like a regular Junkyard with an old car, old toilets and old refrigerators laying around, a Junkyard dog, and just started making little gadgets and features around the game just to tie in with that. And that was basically the last game I had worked on. And I had basically had everything done on the game. They had most of the artwork done, and that's when Williams had their big downsizing. And then whatever else was done on it afterwards had to be taken over by somebody else. But, 95% of the game was already done before I left Williams. I wanted to do something with a wrecking ball because I had never seen anything like it on the game before. In the original version, it had a steel cable that was run by a pulley. You hit a little mechanism and pull the ball up and down. But after everything we designed at Williams, we put the mechanism on a life test. They would run it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and see how many cycles they get. And eventually the cable would get frayed and it would snap. So they ended up changing it to a chain on there. Instead of having the pulley go up and down, they had the whole mechanism move up and down, put the ball and chain on there. And that was basically the last thing I had done with it, before I left.
Okay, so as you indicated, this was, we've really covered your full time at Williams. So looking back over those years you were with Williams, could you say a little about the people you worked with, in particular who you particularly enjoyed working with?
First off would probably be Steve Kordak. I mean, I learned a lot from working with him, and he was sort of like my mentor there. And by the time I started designing, Steve had basically stopped designing, and he was basically just overseeing all of the game designers, but he always had a little input or a little idea, and he was, you know, always very helpful with everything. I mean, there are great programmers, great artists. I mean, I like working with Python, you know, to a certain point. He always did a good job. I worked with him, I worked with, you know, Mark Springer, Connie Mitchell, and mechanical engineers. I remember Joe Jost was very good to work with. He was probably the best mechanical engineer. I worked on several games with him, and after that I worked with a woman named Sophia Bill. And I probably the last three or four games I got, starting from like Dirty Harry, Whodunit, Doctor Who, and Junkyard, she did all the mechanical work on that game, and she's fantastic, and she's still working for WMS in the slot machine department. And then Bill Futzenbrider was probably the best programmer to work with, because he always had good ideas. He was always just very, you know, understanding with that. He knew the games. He liked playing the games. It's hard having somebody program a game and doesn't really get into doing it. They're doing it more as a job. He did it because he enjoyed doing it, and he understood what we're trying to do. So those are probably the best people. I mean, the other designers, I got along fine with all of them. I mean, I knew Mark and Steve for a long time. You know, we had different type of relationships, but it wasn't really working together on a game, just working together for the company. But usually we wouldn't really collaborate much with the other designers and tell them what you're doing. They wouldn't tell you what they're doing, and they didn't really have any kind of input on it. Usually we just had a design team, you know, programmer, artist, and sound guy, and we'd all kind of just work together on what to do with the game.
Okay, thanks very much for that. So, can I just ask you guys out there, have any of you got any questions that you'd like to put to Barry?
Sorry, Dave.
What's your question?
Yeah, sitting on the computer stuff on the IT, one of the things that's on the high school success, it's called Spellbinder.
Uh-huh.
It was a game that didn't go into production.
Okay, could you talk to us about Spellbinder? That was one of your games, not a pinball game.
But that was really a non-pinball game. We had, Steve Ritchie made a game called Hyperball, and they wanted to, I guess, do another similar game. We have the Hyper Cannon, you're basically shooting 50 little balls around in all different directions on there. So I started working on a game called Spellbinder. But by the time I had the game finished and artwork was done, we had built prototype games. I guess Hyperball was starting to fall apart, and they decided not to make a second type of game. But it wasn't basically pinball. They wanted something to play like a video game, where you're constantly shooting at something and just trying, you know, capture some of the people back on there. But I mean, it was a good playing game, just that they had trouble, I guess, with the ball feeder mechanism, where it wasn't reliable. All the time, where the balls would get jammed up, and if the balls can't get to the gun, you can't shoot. And plus, they would overheat. They had to put a fan in there to keep the coils cool.
Thanks. I think I saw another question at the back. Another hand go up.
Okay.
At the front.
Yeah, were you kept busy all the time? Were you sort of going from one project to the other? And were you relatively well paid for that? Because I've heard stories about the likes of Pat Lawler and Steve Ritchie being almost like superstars. You know, they've got all the girls and all the money and everything. Was that true for you?
So, did you work very hard and did they give you lots of money?
A lot more than I'm making now, but... I mean... They would basically pay you, you know, I wouldn't say anything, but they'd pay you a lot more than you were getting if they thought you were going to go somewhere else. They were doing anything to keep you from going to the competition because, I mean, they were number one and they didn't want to be number two. And, I mean, they would always, I mean, you had a basic salary, but the more games you sold, they would give you royalties on the games. if you hit certain levels. You hit 4,000 games, you get one certain level. You hit 5,000 or 10,000 or 15,000, it would increase on there. So a lot of times people were kind of cutthroat on there, trying to keep your run from getting too high because they want to get the game out and make more money. I mean, that was the biggest thing, but they did pay very well. I mean, I'm probably making a third of what I used to make at Williams. That was 20 years ago.
You mentioned about the importance in terms of bonuses of hitting those thresholds and people perhaps wanting to cut back. Were there any of your games where you felt were taken on the taken off the production line prematurely?
I think Doctor Who and Dracula were, because there were other games coming around at the same time. When did Adam's Family come out? Was it around the same time?
1992.
Yeah, whatever somebody else had been doing after that, it seemed like they would, Steve Ritchie or Pat Lawler, would talk to management and try and talk them into getting their game a lot sooner and maybe cutting back the production run on the game. I think some of the games could have done a lot more.
All right. Thanks. Any more questions? Oh, over there.
So I was just wondering, I know some designers are infamous, because I'm very interested in like the programming of pinball games and stuff like that. I know some designers were really kind of, they had a strong say on the rules for their games. They worked really, you know, they kind of imposed something on their programmers. And I know some kind of didn't, they really left it up to them. You know, once they designed the game, the rules were another matter. I was just wondering kind of, because I think, you know, some of the games you made really great rules, and I was wondering kind of what the process was like with that, especially on the later games, like Dirty Harry, Jackpot, stuff like that.
Okay. So I think the question is, how involved were you in coming up with rule sets for the games that you designed? What was the process? With games like Dirty Harry, for example, what was your involvement in the rules on that?
I mean, in the past, I think I had come up with the rules for, like, all the games, did all that myself, but with the later games, where they got a little more complex, we basically had, like, a team meeting every week. We'd have the designer and the programmer and the artist and even the sound guy. We'd all sit around a table basically talking about the game, what we could do to improve it. You'll have an idea for rules, and maybe somebody else may have a way of making it even better. So, I mean, nobody wanted to be a dictator, at least on the teams that I worked with. I mean, you probably had the final say so on it, but if I thought somebody had a better idea, I wouldn't shoot them down because I thought my idea was better, if theirs was actually better, though. But the later games, usually like the programmer and the designer would basically work on most of the rules.
So I think what you're saying is that, I'm trying to distill the sense of what you said, but essentially the programmer and the designer were responsible for the rules. You had your views, but you're open to ideas from other people.
Right, I mean, I try to come up with the full set of rules and then just basically look for input, what I can do to improve it, because I'm sure somebody will have a better idea, maybe.
Okay, thanks for that. Any more questions?
You come up with a missed multi-ball in design. A missed multi-ball in
design. Oh, how about you come up to the missed multi-ball concept on Dracula?
The original design, really, for Dracula was a different, completely different theme. And it was supposed to be a tie-in with the Alien 3 movie. And it was supposed to be a feature that we would tie in with the aliens, but there was a delay with the movie because they were rewriting the script. And they said they couldn't have the movie ready in time for having the game done. So they offered us Dracula, and I ended up just basically keeping the game design and just changing the rules, adding a few more features, and I wanted to do something with the moving ball on the game, because people for years kept saying, these games are rigged, there's magnets in the games, and they're trying to cheat us. So I decided, why not put a ball and have the people actually see the ball moving, trying to figure out how it's being done. But it was done in a good way, where if you do hit the ball, you're going to get an extra bonus or a multi-ball.
I think there was a question at the back.
In like late 80s, there was
like the fish with how many powers involved, either hidden or quite involved in the game. And that's kind of progressed through Adam's family and later on. Talk a little bit about cows and wings and how that came about.
Okay, so we're talking about Easter eggs, and in particular, the cows that tended to pop out of games. Like, I think in Hurricane, there's a cow that comes up on the Dot Matrix and gets sawn in half with a chainsaw. Can you say anything about how that came about?
In fire,
there was a sound effect. I think in Pinball, you've got Old MacDonald had a farm. In Pinball. Cow and Doctor Who. Do you know, where did that start from?
There was something, I think either the programmers or the sound guys or the Dot Matrix guys, more on the technical guys, were just playing around basically, putting something comical, and they tried to put it in every game on there. I mean, I really had nothing to do with it. I don't think Steve Ritchie or Mark Ritchie or anybody else had anything to do with it. It was just something they wanted just to throw into the game for humor.
So it sounds like we're blaming it on the software guys.
Right.
Okay, next question. Okay, I've got a question for you, and that's, we've really been looking at your past. There's been some rumours going around about your involvement in a game called Pinball Gremlins. Can you tell us who's involved in that and what your part is in all of it?
There's a company called Vonnie D that's, I think over in the St. Louis area, and they had approached me several months ago and wanted me to do some work with them, and they'd sent me basically a rough playfield drawing and a rough set of rules and wanted me to help them out with it. But I told them I need a lot more, and I need to know, you know, what everything, all the features are on the game, the characters, what, you know, what you want them to do, so I can do something with the rules. And really haven't heard much back from them since then. They said they would let me know, and that was about it. But I saw they had my name posted up there that I was actually working with them, but haven't done anything.
Okay, we've got a question.
Yeah, one thing is, how did you get the balance between playability and a long game for somebody, and then the demands of for operators needing it to be over quite quickly? So from a player's point of view, they want a good long game, but from an operator's point of view, they need it to be short.
Okay, so the question's about the trade-off between the player that would like the game to last a long time, but the operators that want really the game to be over sooner, so that the player or another player can put another quarter in the slot or whatever the coin can use.
I think a lot of it started off with we would build up a few games and we'd put them in certain areas in the factory there where people could play the game, and we would basically check the ball time to see how long the games lasted. This basically is a test run, and then also we put the games out on test. And since everything was electronic, you can keep an idea how many balls were played, how many games were played, how many minutes were played, and usually they try to keep it down to like 30 seconds a ball, so we basically adjust the out lane so we get it down to that, around that amount, and people that wanted longer would close it up, and people that wanted shorter games could move it the other way. We try to get like a 30 second average on it.
Okay, thanks for that. Another question? Okay, come on, talk now about, I believe that you've got a connection with the Full Throttle game through someone that you used to work with who's got their name on the trams line, Jack Hager.
Yeah, I knew Jack Hager at Williams. I didn't actually work on him because he was doing mostly videos, but we were friends when he started working. I used to hang out, my wife and I would hang out with him and his wife, and also about Constantino Mitchell, who did some of the earlier games from Phoenix, and Gorgar and his wife, like the six of us would go out to dinner or sometimes just hang out on the weekends. And so I mean, I've known Jack since, it must have been like 1978 or 79 around there. I just never actually had a chance to work with them, just work at the same company and talk to them there and see him on the outside.
Okay, so drawing to a close, a final question for you, and that is, what would you give to an aspiring young chap that was perhaps thinking of starting his own pinball company?
That's a young.
get ready for the ride of your life, I guess. I mean, you need to have a lot of patience and a lot of money, I guess, to get started with it. Because it takes a lot to get the game going. And God, I mean, I don't know what to say. We have to find the right people to work, the right designer, right programmer, right artist, just to make the whole package look good and just make a good game that's reliable. And that's probably the biggest thing of all.
So in summary, get the right people and make a good game that's reliable. Yep. Okay, well, with that, Barry, that draws our time together to a close. I'd like to thank you for making the trip over the water to come and see us all and share the insights into your game designs and your life in pinball. Thank you very much.
Thank you.